Exodus chapter 32, please, in your Bibles. Exodus chapter 32. While you're turning there, Brother Paul has provided ribbons for those who are memorizing through the chronological reading through the Bible. And if you are memorizing the verses and you indicated that you would like a ribbon, you had to have indicated that you wanted a ribbon. Those are on the back table, because he made as many as those who indicated that they wanted one. So please, if you did not indicate that you wanted one of these, don't take it. Leave that for others. If you would like to have that the next time it comes around, see Brother Halad. Anyway, this is the verse we're memorizing for this month, Joshua 21:45. There failed not aught of any good thing which the Lord had spoken unto the house of Israel. All came to pass. That's that verse that you'll see on the back table there. I appreciate him doing that. This is of great help as a marker in your Bibles. Exodus chapter 32. You're going to notice that the title of this message is similar to 2 weeks ago, except that I added in the particular thing we're going to look at tonight. A couple of weeks ago, the title was "Those Who Turned Aside Quickly." Turning aside quickly. Tonight, we're looking at the imagination of those who turned aside quickly. Let's read chapter 32, verses 1 through 9, and then we'll begin the message here. And when the people saw that Moses delayed to come down out of the mount, the people gathered themselves together unto Aaron and said unto him, "Up, make us gods, which shall go before us. For as for this Moses, the man that brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we wot not," that is, we don't know what has become of him. And Aaron said unto them, "Break off the golden earrings which are in your ear, in the ears of your wives, of your sons and of your daughters, and bring them unto me." And all the people break off the golden earrings which were in their ears and brought them unto Aaron. And he received them at their hand and fashioned it with a graving tool. After he had made it a molten calf, and they said, "These be thy gods, O Israel, which brought thee up out of the land of Egypt." And when Aaron saw it, he built an altar before it. And Aaron made proclamation and said, "Tomorrow is a feast to the Lord." And they rose up early on the morrow and offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings. And the people sat down to eat and to drink and rose up to play. And the Lord said unto Moses, "Go, get thee down, for thy people which thou broughtest out of the land of Egypt have corrupted themselves. They have turned aside quickly out of the way which I commanded them. They have made them a molten calf, and have worshipped it, and have sacrificed thereunto, and said, 'These be thy gods, O Israel, which have brought thee up out of the land of Egypt.'" And the Lord said unto Moses, "I have seen this people, and behold, it is a stiff-necked people. They have turned aside quickly out of the way which I commanded them." Verse 8. Verse 9, they are a stiff-necked people. They are literally a hard-necked people. And again, as we have said before, that's an expression based upon farm animals refusing to have the yoke put upon their necks in order to work. Stubborn, headstrong, stiff-necked, bull-headed, pig-headed. We've made this observation. Every person has a yoke around your neck. Figuratively, you have a yoke around your neck. What is it, or who is it you are yoked up with? Jesus is the one who said, "Take my yoke upon you and learn of me, for I am meek and lowly of heart. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light." We've made the observation that Jesus didn't promise that the work wouldn't be hard, but he did promise that the yoke is not hard. And when we're in a yoke with him, we can do anything. Even the burden seems light when you're yoked with him. We're looking at three signs of a person who has become hard. It's not something that necessarily takes place overnight. It's something that is a process. It doesn't start that way. You don't start out hard-necked. You don't start out stiff-necked. There's a process to becoming hard. And in Exodus 32:8, God is speaking to Moses. Three signs of a person who's become hard: impatient, imaginative, idolatrous. Those three signs, impatient, imaginative, idolatrous, are also steps to becoming stiff-necked. In other words, the idolatrous had to have been imaginative. It's interesting when you see people come up with their idols. How did they ever come up with that? They had an evil imagination. Imagination leads to idolatry, but there's a step that goes first, and that's impatience. We reviewed that God spoke the Ten Commandments directly to the children of Israel. The children of Israel replied in Exodus 20:19 after those Ten Commandments were given. It said to Moses, "Let not God speak with us, lest we die." So Moses ascends the mount in chapter 20. God speaks to Moses directly and tells him, "You tell the people." And that's what you see in Exodus 21, 22, and 23. The judgments which Moses was to tell the people. Go back to chapter 24. And again, we'll note that in chapter 24 and verse 12, God is going to instruct Moses about the tabernacle, which he does. You'll see that in chapter 25, verses 8 and 9. "Let them make me a sanctuary that I may dwell among them according to all that I shall show thee after the pattern of the tabernacle and the pattern of the instruments thereof. Even so shall ye make it." And that's what we've been looking at for the last number of months, is the tabernacle, what God gives Moses directly. But also what is taking place according to chapter 24 and verse 12 is God is going to give him written in stone the Ten Commandments. And in review, Moses says this in Deuteronomy 4:13, "God declared unto you his covenant, which he commanded you to perform, even Ten Commandments, and he wrote them upon two tables of stone." I pointed out the article that I had read in the little publication called Imprimis. In the early years of printing, it would be printed, "The heard voice perishes, but the written letter remains." And the writer of that article made this observation: "Our civilization, in which the great majority of inhabitants as Christians and Jews have been people of the book, is fast becoming a civilization inhabited by people of the screen, people tied to the ever-changing, ever-fluid, ever-malleable presentation of the past made possible by the nature of digital technology." But the whole point is, the heard voice perishes, but the written letter remains. God said, "I'm going to put it in stone." So the background to Exodus chapter 32 is Exodus 24, verses 9 to 18. And so if you're there in Exodus chapter 24, note verse 18, "Moses went into the midst of the cloud and got him up into the mount. And Moses was in the mount 40 days and 40 nights. And those 40 days compose the next 7 chapters where God instructs and shows Moses the pattern for building the tabernacle. And he writes the Ten Commandments in stone. And then you're in chapter 31, verse 18. And he gave unto Moses when he had made an end of communing with him upon Mount Sinai, 2 tables of testimony, tables of stone, written with the finger of God. Meanwhile, what's happening at the base of the mount? When the people saw that Moses delayed to come down out of the mount, we see that they are impatient. This is our first point. They were impatient. Moses delayed. "As for this Moses, we don't know what's happened to him. He's been gone a mere 40 days." But when you're in the wilderness at the base of a mount, how long is 40 days seem? I mean, what was 40 days ago? This is September 15th, 30 days ago, August 15th. Go back 10 more days, August the 5th. That's a long time ago. When you're waiting, wouldn't you get impatient? Let's not be so critical of them that we don't also realize we're the same way. We become impatient with God. But they knew where he was. But Moses delayed, and remember that has the idea of causing them shame. They became impatient, and no doubt it was due to the mixed multitude among them, an observation we had made last time. Numbers 11:4, this mixed multitude is recorded as impatient. And no doubt they're almost mocking the rest of the children of Israel. "This is ridiculous. Why are we standing down here waiting? He's probably, look at the fire up there." That's where we heard, that's where we saw the lightning and all that. He's gone. And he became impatient. Their leader's gone. The pastor's up there. I'm not trying to put the pastor on the same level with Moses, please understand. I'm just saying that when the leader's gone, when the cat's away, what's the saying? The mouse will play. And it's evident in every church. It's evident here. It's evident here. But I think the true spiritual condition of people is known by what they do when they're left to themselves. I think the true spiritual condition of people is, what do they do when the pastor's gone? What do they do when the overseer, the one who keeps his eyes upon people, what do they do? We made the observation about the condition of Christendom right now. It's almost like people no longer really believe that Jesus could return at any moment. He's causing us shame. We keep talking about his second coming, and yet it's never happened. And the mixed multitude that's among us begins doubting that he's ever going to come back. It's 2 Peter chapter 3. And so, wouldn't you like to know what's happening in heaven right now? Up there, where God is, the mount, while we are down here. But we don't need to know, we just need to take it by faith. You know that God's there. He's going to send his son when he's ready. He knows what we don't. But what was happening at the top of the mount, Moses was just about to return. And at the base of the mount, here's what they're doing. And I really wonder if that's not a good picture of the Lord's return. That he's about to return, and people are here going, well, where is he? And they begin to beat up on each other, as Jesus says in that parable. The servants, you know, they're not even watching. They're not waiting. They're getting impatient. So what people do in the absence of their human leaders reveals what kind of people they really are. In their hearts, these people were manipulators of a weak assistant to Moses. Look at verse 21. Moses said unto Aaron, What did this people unto thee that thou hast brought so great a sin upon them? Aaron, what did they do that you have brought this sin upon them? A weak assistant. And I believe that Aaron was easily manipulated because he was an exaggerator. Do you see anything about Aaron exaggerating in this chapter? If you look at verse 24, you see his exaggeration. Well, I said unto them, whosoever hath any gold, let him break it off. So they gave it to me, and then I cast it into the fire, and this calf came out. That's kind of an exaggeration. And Aaron was easily manipulated because he was an exaggerator. And I note something else here. An assistant must be faithful to the one he assists, not to the people he leads. An assistant must be faithful to the one he serves, not to the people he leads. When they saw that Moses caused them shame, verse 1, it says, they gathered themselves together unto. Just take that word unto, and in your notes write against. They gathered themselves together against Aaron. It's like the commentator said, they beset him in a violent and tumultuous manner, clamorously demanding of him that he should yield to their wishes. That's really the idea here. It's not like they came to Aaron and said, you know, we've got a proposal. We'd like to take a vote. This is a democracy, you know, and we would just like to take a vote here. That's not what's happening. They are coming with what they have in mind already, and they're gathering together against him, tumultuous. It's like a mob. And they're saying, we don't know what's happened to him, so you need to do something. Are we hearing anything about people saying you need to do something lately? There's all these shootings. What are you going to do, congressman? And so, what do these congressmen feel like? Oh, I got to do something. Well, let's make a law. let's ban ARs. Okay, good. Maybe that'll soothe them for a while. And they always do something that's an exaggeration, something way off that doesn't solve anything. So who's leading? Who's leading? If you say it's Aaron, then why is it that the people can get him to do exactly what they want to do? Who's leading? It's the people who are leading. The people are commanding Aaron, but now that Aaron has been commanded too, then he commands them in verse 2. Aaron said unto them, break off the golden earrings which are in the ears of your wives, of your sons, and of your daughters, and bring them unto me. Well, now that tickles them. Now that's something they say, okay, now we're getting somewhere. And that reminds me of 2 Timothy 4:3 and 4, for the time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine, but after their own lusts shall they heap to themselves teachers, Aaron, having itching ears, and they shall turn their ears from the truth and shall be turned unto fables. That's why the leader must do what it says in the verses prior to what I just read you. Preach the word. Be instant in season, out of season. Reprove, rebuke, exhort with all longsuffering and doctrine. That's what Aaron should have done. What do you people think you're doing? Reprove them. Rebuke them. Exhort them. Long suffering and doctrine. So that's the first sign or the first step of a person who's become stiff-necked. They're impatient. Well, that brings us to our second one tonight, the one that's in the title. They were also imaginative. Imaginative. Up! Make us gods! It's interesting as you go into the later prophets, Jeremiah and so forth. Jeremiah, God is almost mockingly talking about how people create an idol. You go out into the woods, you chop the tree down, you cut it into thirds. One third you use to warm yourself by the fire, you burn that wood. Another third you take and burn that so that you can cook your meals. The other third you say, now this third we're going to take and we're going to create something, and you carve out this idol. So with one third you warm yourself, with one third you warm the food that you want to eat, and then with the other third you bow down and worship it. Doesn't that kind of require an imagination? It's like, okay, this third I burn, this third I worship. Same wood, same thing. And you go, how ridiculous is this? I mean, how stupid can these people be? How absolutely stupid can they be? And we look at them and don't think about what we do ourselves. Imaginative. You know, there's six things that God hates. The seventh is an abomination to him. But it's the fourth and the fifth where it says in Proverbs 6:16-19, an heart that deviseth wicked imaginations, feet that be swift in running to mischief. And that aptly describes the children of Israel here in Exodus chapter 32. It aptly describes the tendency of people who, when their leader is absent, they do what is right in their own eyes due to their imagination. When they have to wait, their imagination becomes fertile ground for wickedness and mischief. It's all prone. All of us are prone to do this if we don't allow God to control our thinking. Because it's in our thinking where our imagination is. And our imagination, you know what I'm talking about when I say your imagination runs wild. And we've got to be careful with our imaginations. So what applies to these people in the plural applies to us as individuals, singular. That's the application tonight. Three things about their imagination. Number one, they imagine themselves left behind. They imagine themselves left behind. Notice what it says there again in verse 1. For as for Moses, now I left a word out and I want you to catch it, so follow along with me as I read this. For as for Moses, the man that brought us up out of the land of Egypt, what word did I leave out? This. That is a word that is full of sarcasm. For as for this Moses, For as for this Moses, why didn't they just say for as for Moses? They're expressing scorn here. They imagine themselves as having been forsaken by Moses and thus by God. We've been forsaken. We've been left behind. A man is in big trouble when he imagines this. A man is in big trouble when he imagines God has forsaken me. When I feel like God has left me behind, folks, you're in big trouble. That's why before he dies, Moses emphasizes something to the children of Israel. Maybe Moses is thinking back to this time. Go with me to Deuteronomy chapter 31, where Moses is sure to remind the children of Israel of what he says in Deuteronomy chapter 31, verse 6. Be strong and of a good courage. Fear not, nor be afraid of them, for the Lord thy God, it is that doth go with thee. He will not fail thee. He will not forsake thee. And Moses called unto Joshua and said unto him in the sight of all Israel, be strong and of a good courage, for thou must go with this people unto the land which the Lord hath sworn unto their fathers to give them. And thou shalt cause them to inherit it. And the Lord, he it is that doth go before thee. He will be with thee. He will not fail thee, neither forsake thee. Fear not, neither be dismayed. Joshua repeats this. Just turn a couple of pages to Joshua chapter 1. And now Joshua repeats something in Joshua chapter 1 and verse 5. God is saying to Joshua, there shall not any man be able to stand before thee all the days of thy life. As I was with Moses, so I will be with thee. Joshua, I will not fail thee. I will not forsake thee. You read on. Be strong and of a good courage, for unto this people shalt thou divide for an inheritance the land which I swear unto their fathers to give them. Here we go again, verse 7. Joshua, only be thou strong and very courageous, that thou mayest observe to do according to all the law which Moses my servant commanded thee. Turn not from it to the right hand or to the left, that thou mayest prosper whithersoever thou goest. The people's responsibility is there in verse 7. They're able to do 7 by practicing verse 8. This book of the law shall not depart out of thy mouth, but thou shalt meditate therein day and night, that thou mayest observe to do according to all that is written therein. For then thou shalt make thy way prosperous, and then thou shalt have good success. He repeats it in verse 9. Have not I commanded thee? Be strong and be of a good courage. Be not afraid, neither be thou dismayed, for the Lord thy God is with thee, whithersoever thou goest. Time and time again, God repeats it. Moses repeats it. God is with us. He will not forsake us. When you know that, you can do anything. When you realize that God is with me, you can do anything. How do you know God is with you? Because he promised. You're a Christian. Is he with you? He's not only with you, he's in you. I mean, there is something true to the little statement we make to the little kids. You need to ask Jesus into your heart. And a child's thinking, how does that happen? Because Jesus himself said, I will be with you. In fact, I will be in you. The Comforter will come. Folks, he has not forsaken us. You can be all alone out in the middle of nowhere, in the midst of a sea of a bunch of heathens. God is there with you. He is in you. He will not forsake you. These people, we've been forsaken. And when you imagine that you're forsaken, that's when you're in trouble. You say, well, you know, this was made to the Old Testament people. Well, let's just go to Hebrews chapter 13. Let's go to the New Testament. Let's see if we might have some kind of a same promise given to us. Hebrews chapter 13. This is how we know that we can take Old Testament promises that are given to people and apply them to us as New Testament believers. Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 5. Let your behavior, your conversation be without covetousness, and be content with such things as ye have. For he hath said, I will never leave thee nor forsake thee. Now, if you do a Bible study and try to find, because he says, he hath said, so the writer of Hebrews is saying, he hath said, well, where did he say it? You know where you're going to find it? Deuteronomy 31. It's what God told the children of Israel. It's what Moses told the children of Israel. It's what God told Joshua. So the writer of Hebrews is saying what God told them applies to us today. That's why, folks, you can take Old Testament promises that are given to God's people there and apply those to God's people today. The same principles. That is significant because some believers today question the wisdom of applying Old Testament principles to New Testament believers. That's what the writer of Hebrews does. God will not forsake us. I say again, if I just know that God is with me, I can do anything. And it's not me doing it, it's God. But anything can be accomplished. And that's the very thing that Moses is now going to challenge God with. Lord, if you don't go with me, I'm not going. I can't go. And God promises, I'm going to be with you, Moses. But they imagined themselves left behind. That's number one. Number two, they imagined themselves liberated. They imagined themselves liberated. What do I mean by that? Well, they jettisoned the yoke of God's law and rushed to put on another yoke. The yoke of Egypt. You know, we're really free to do whatever we like. Jeremiah 6:15 says, talking about the people in Jeremiah's day, were they ashamed when they had committed abomination? Nay, they were not at all ashamed, neither could they blush. Do you get it? Moses, in his delaying, had caused them shame. But doing something as absurd as building a calf out of gold and then declaring, these be thy gods, O Israel, which brought thee up out of the land of Egypt, causes them no shame? Moses delaying causes them shame, but doing this doesn't cause them shame? They imagine a God who can do what the one they were waiting on was supposed to do. To take them into the promised land. But we wot not what happened to Moses. For as for this Moses, we don't know what happened to him. Do something, Aaron, do something. And then the imaginations run wild. And people will do anything when the imagination goes wild. It's ironic because while Moses is up on the mount receiving a plan for God's tabernacle to dwell among his people, the people, meanwhile, are down at the base of the mountain, imagining the creation of a God they are able to see among them. A God who gives them liberty to do what you see them doing in this chapter. They've got freedom here. This is true freedom, right? When God has delivered us from Egypt, folks, we can do what we want. That's what Christians say today. We can do what we want. What should the people have done? Have you ever asked yourself this question? I was asking myself this question. What should these people have done when they got impatient? Or when they began to think, we're deserted. We've been left behind. And I came to the conclusion that what they should have done is exactly what you find Moses doing later. They should have interceded for Moses just like Moses later intercedes for them. If they truly wondered what happened to him, how about praying and saying, Lord, we want to pray for Moses, the man we earlier lifted up his hands to support him when we were in battle. You think God may have answered them? They should have interceded on Moses' behalf as he now does on their behalf. Look at verses 11 to 14. And Moses besought the Lord his God and said, Lord, why doth thy wrath wax hot against thy people, which thou hast brought forth out of the land of Egypt with a great power and a mighty hand? Wherefore should the Egyptians speak and say, because God had said he was going to destroy them. For mischief did he bring them out to slay them in the mountains and to consume them from the face of the earth. Turn from thy fierce wrath and repent of this evil against thy people. Remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, thy servants, to whom thou swearest by thine own self and saidst unto them, I will multiply your seed as the stars of heaven. And all this land that I have spoken of will I give unto your seed, and they shall inherit it forever. And the Lord repented of the evil which he thought to do unto his people. Oh, if they had just interceded on Moses' behalf. That's maturity when you have people praying for their leader instead of just saying, well, he's forsaken us, let's go do what we want. That's truly a people who have really been, have learned, you know what? Let's do what our leader would have done for us. And they pray for him. Well, when they imagine themselves liberated, now, and here this third point, they imagine themselves liberal. I'm talking about progressive. You go ahead and make the political association. Now they imagine themselves liberal, forward-thinking, broad-minded, open-minded. So they imagine a God. Now that's progressive. Ain't nobody else ever done something like that. Right? You know what? That liberalism is just wickedness just rehashed all over again. Up, make us gods, you see there in verse 1. Up, make us gods. Now, you look at the word gods, and remember the word Elohim? It's the word Elohim. And if you remember from our study some time ago, Elohim is in the plural. Go back to verse 18, written with the finger of Elohim. Look at 32:1. Up, make us Elohim. The exact same word. Now think about this. The exact same word God that ends chapter 31, verse 18, can be translated either singularly, as it is in 31:18, or in the plural. So what are they saying here? Up make us gods or up make us a god? To answer that, go to Nehemiah chapter 9. And as Nehemiah is recounting this very same episode, I want you to notice what he says in Nehemiah chapter 9 and verse 18. It's really a matter of translation, but you see in 9:18 of Nehemiah, yea, when they had made them a molten calf and said, this is thy God, singular, that brought thee up out of the land of Egypt and had wrought great provocations. The whole point is this. The fact that what they say is up make us gods, plural, is probably up make us a god. Because how many golden calves did they make? One. So what they're literally saying there in verse 1 is up, make us a god. Make us a god. So apparently their relationship with God was only as real as it was with the man they could see. By making a god to replace Moses, they are imagining a man had been their god. And you've got to really follow that kind of thing. It's, you know, as I study this, and this is just really so theologically interesting. The overwhelming desire, Davis says in his commentary, for visible representation of their religious ideas led them into this sin. They want a visible representation. It is indeed amazing that a people would adopt that which was clearly condemned and shown to be useless in the 10 plagues. This record, however, serves as a lesson and a warning to all who feel that miracles are the final answer to weak faith. They had witnessed great and spectacular miracles, and it encouraged them for a moment. But it does not guarantee a mature faith that will resist the temptations that lie ahead. So this is a warning that a miracle is the answer to a weak faith. So to whom are the people of Israel crediting for bringing them up out of Egypt? Who do they say brought them out of Egypt? Again, let's read verse 1 of chapter 32. For as for this Moses, the man that brought us up out of the land, who do they ascribe their deliverance to? It's ascribed to Moses. Go to verse 23. For they said unto me, Aaron is saying, make us gods, or a god, which shall go before us. For as for this Moses, the man that brought us up out of the land of Egypt. So the people are saying, it is Moses who brought us up out of the land of Egypt. But now notice something else. Not only did they ascribe it to Moses, so did God. Look at verse 7. And the Lord said unto Moses, go get thee down, for thy people which thou broughtest out of the land of Egypt have corrupted themselves. Look at chapter 33 and verse 1. The Lord said unto Moses, depart and go up hence, thou and the people which thou hast brought up out of the land of Egypt. So God himself says that Moses brought them out, just like the people said it. Is this God's way of scathingly saying to Moses what the people said? Because who did bring them out? Who did bring them out? Let's go to chapter 20. Verse 1. And God spake all these words, saying, I am the Lord thy God, which have brought thee out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. And then immediately he gives the Ten Commandments, the first two of which are in verses 3 and 5, 3 to 5. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Folks, get this. They're ascribing this to Moses. God is scathingly ascribing it to Moses. Who brought them up? God did. And it was based upon that very fact that he says, you shall have no other gods before me. And what is the very first thing they break? What is the very first commandment they break? Before God even gives it to them in writing, they had heard him speak this. They had heard his voice. And he said, thou shalt have no other gods before me. Furthermore, thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. Thou shalt not bow down to them nor serve them. For I, the Lord thy God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children unto the third and fourth generation of them that hate me. Don't make any kind of an image. And what is the very thing they're doing at the base of the mountain? Well, God has given these Ten Commandments to Moses written in stone. They're doing the very thing he said don't do. And he said, I'm the one who brought them out. And then God himself says in chapter 20, what you read in verses 22 and 23. And the Lord said unto Moses, thus shalt thou say unto the children of Israel, ye have seen that I have talked to you from heaven. Ye shall not make with me gods of silver, neither shall ye make you gods of gold. And it is emphasized time and time again. But now I want to say something else. Go back to chapter 3 of Exodus. Let's see who really brought the children of Israel out of Egypt. Exodus chapter 3. This is God's call upon Moses in chapter 3. Verse 7, and the Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people which are in Egypt, and have heard their cry by reason of their taskmasters, for I know their sorrows. Verse 8, and I am come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out. God says, I'm going to bring them up. Out of that land, unto a land, a good land and a large, unto a land flowing with milk and honey, unto the place of the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Amorites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites. Verse 9, now therefore, behold, the cry of the children of Israel has come unto me, and I have also seen the oppression wherewith the Egyptians oppress them. So who brings them out of the land of Egypt, folks? God does. Wait, verse 10. Exodus 3. Come now, therefore, and I will send thee unto Pharaoh, that thou mayest bring forth my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. Who's bringing them out? God is. Moses is. Keep reading, verse 11. Moses said unto God, who am I that I should go unto Pharaoh and that I should bring forth the children of Israel out of Egypt? Who am I? I can't do this. God replies, verse 12, certainly I will be with thee, and this shall be a token unto thee that I have sent thee, when thou hast brought forth the people out of Egypt, ye shall serve God upon this mountain. Go down to verse 17. God speaking again, and I have said, I will bring you up out of the affliction of Egypt. I'm the one who's going to bring you out. Unto the land of the Canaanites, the Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, Jebusites, unto a land flowing with milk and honey. But then read verse 18. And they shall hearken to thy voice, and thou shalt come, thou and the elders of Israel, unto the king of Egypt, and ye shall say unto him, the Lord God of the Hebrews hath met with us, and now let us go, we beseech thee, 3 days into the wilderness, that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God. Folks, who brought them up? Who brought them out of Egypt? God did. Moses did. Was it God or Moses? Yes. But ultimately, who is it? It's God. Who planted this church? Didn't you help? Couldn't you say we did? But ultimately, who do we give the glory to for the planting of this church? The glory goes to God. But do you recognize those who have been involved in it? You do. But now here's the danger. Here's where we get into trouble. Ultimately, Moses realizes he did so by the hand of God. Go back to chapter 32. And Moses is talking to God. And Moses is responding to what God said to him in verse 7. God says in verse 7, you brought them out. Moses says in verse 11, which thou hast brought forth. When you conveniently attribute to man what should be attributed to God, you are getting into idolatry. And when you idolize a man and that man disappoints you, and he will, you will go to another extreme and you will create your own God. Folks, this is what is happening. Pastors are disappointing people because people set them up as gods. They set them up as, well, you know, he should be perfect. And, you know, 1 Timothy chapter 3 says blameless and so forth and so on. It doesn't say sinless. It says blameless. And yet when he makes one slight mistake, I'm leaving. I'm out of here. Well, who did you have your eyes set on? Come on. Who were you idolizing? Who were you saying? Come on, think about this. I'm telling you, we do the same thing today that these people are doing. And so their imagination runs wild. And sometimes what people do, this is what unbelievers do with Christians. If that's what a Christian is, forget it. And they look at you and they say, if that's what a Christian is, I'm not interested. But Christians do this with other Christians. Well, if that's what a fundamentalist is, forget it. And then you know what they do? They go to their own extreme. And they start their own brand of fundamentalism. I'm thinking about somebody right now. Many of you know him. Who was disappointed by some fundamentalists. So he left them. And now is trying to create his own brand of fundamentalism that is totally disappointing. That is a total extreme. It's almost like this right here. It's the imagination. You become impatient, the imagination starts running wild. And you go to other extremes. God has forsaken us. But now we're liberated to do what we want to. And then you become liberal in your mind. I'm talking about political. I'm talking about spiritual. Now you become liberal. I can do anything now. Because God's forsaken me. Well, you know, it's up to me now. Everybody do that which is right in his own eyes, and now you do your own thing. Six things God hates, two of which, a heart that deviseth wicked imaginations, and feet that be swift and running to mischief. That aptly describes the children of Israel in Exodus chapter 32. But the question we have to ask ourselves tonight is, does that aptly describe you? Does that describe you?